about the nearest neighbor algorithm, and we stopped right here. We were talking about why nearest neighbor is slow, and the basic reason has to do with the fact that when you see a two or three dimensional space, it's very easy for you as a human to identify the nearest neighbors of a point. If I ask you what the nearest neighbors of the red point are, you can see it immediately. You don't actually have to compute anything, right? But this is what you see. What the algorithm sees is a list of numbers, a list of coordinates for the points, for the training points, and a list of coordinates for the testing point. And if you look at it this way, it's not at all trivial what the nearest neighbors are for this testing point. Right? So really, the only alternative that you have is to go ahead and compute the distance from this point to each one of the training examples. Now, if you were actually doing it in so here's another thing. Suppose you were doing it in one dimension only. Does that still apply? Would you still have to compare to everything if it was in 1D? Yes?
You could sort them.
You can sort them. Yes. Okay. And if you sort them, then you don't actually have to compare to everything, right? Because if you sort the numbers, you get a new number. How do you find where this number is in the list? Binary search, yay. So binary search, logarithmic number of steps, you find where the number is in the list. And then you don't actually have to compare. If you're looking for 10 nearest neighbors, you just go to the left, go to the right, go to the left, go to the right, until you find 10 points that are most similar to your current point. So in 1D, this is not a problem. Now, can you do the same in 2D? Well, it turns out that yes, you can, but it's not nearly as easy as in 1D. Why? Because how are you going to sort, right? In 1D, it's obvious how you sort. In 2D, there isn't a natural sorting algorithm that's going to put you. Now, it turns out that there is actually an algorithm for finding the nearest neighbors very quickly in logarithmic time in 2D. But sadly, that's where the fun stops. Right? Once you go beyond 2D, things are bad, and there isn't an algorithm for n-dimensional space where you can quickly find the nearest neighbors without comparing the distances to all the training examples, right? So that's the bad part, and that's what we have to deal with. Now, there isn't an exact algorithm, but we can always try to approximate things. And that's what I'm going to briefly talk about now before Charles takes over and starts talking about completely different types of learning methods. So, nearest neighbors. We mentioned complexity briefly, right? So the computational complexity for k-nearest neighbors, at training phase, there is no complexity. Why?
There's no training phase.
Well, there is no training phase. You're not really doing anything. You're just taking this data point and you're sticking it somewhere so that later you can compare to it. So you can imagine that it has some complexity, but it's really negligible, right? You're just dumping the point somewhere. Now, at the testing time, what do you have to do? You have n points to compare to, so you must make n comparisons. Each comparison takes big D operations, right? Why big D? Big D is typically the dimensionality of the data. So if I have a 1,000-dimensional vector, and I have another 1,000-dimensional vectors, it's going to take me about 1,000 operations to measure the distance between them. So the total complexity is m times d for one testing instance. So this is what I want to reduce. This is expensive. If you imagine doing this on text, then d is 100,000 and growing, keeps long. N is, if you do it on a large data set, m could easily be in the millions. And as you get more and more training data, m gets bigger and bigger. So it gets more and more expensive to do stuff. So what you want to do is you want to try to reduce that. Now, you can reduce that in two ways. You can either try to make d smaller, and this is called dimensionality reduction, or you can try to make m smaller. Now, what is d smaller? D smaller, you're basically trying to reduce the dimensionality of the data. You're saying, well, I got 1,000 attributes, maybe I don't need 1,000. Later in the course, we're going to have a lecture on how to do that. What I wanted to say here is when we say how to do that, it doesn't actually work as a solution to this. The method that I'm going to describe, it's roughly cubic in the number of dimensions. And if the number of dimensions is huge, then cubic is not a good thing. Right? So you wouldn't actually be able to do it. There's a much simpler way, which basically means you look at your set of dimensions, 1,000 or however many you got, and then you try to just throw away some of them. Right? And does anyone have a guess of, you know, from what you know now in the course, how would you throw away irrelevant dimensions? Have we talked about any technique for throwing away irrelevant stuff?
Entropy.
Entropy, yay. So not just entropy, but basically information gain. So that's one way that you could measure how useful an attribute is. And it's not terribly difficult to compute.
Right.
So that's something that you could use. You can compute information gain for each one of your 1,000 examples, and then see what happens if I, you know, if it has a low gain, then maybe if I throw this attribute away, it's not going to hurt things that much. So that's a way to reduce D. Now, most of the active research is actually not on how you reduce D, but how you reduce N. So how can you reduce N? N is the total number of data points that you compare to. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to say, look, maybe I don't have to compare to everything. Maybe I can quickly identify a small number of potential nearest neighbors and just compare to those. So if I can get a small number, little n, and just compare to them, I'm going to make some mistakes, but maybe that's not too bad. So that's a viable solution. It is going to make everything faster. And there are a number of solutions for specific types of data. So if you're dealing with low-dimensional data and numeric data, there's a technique called KD trees, which I'm going to talk about next, that can help you solve the problem with some mistakes. But this doesn't work if you have high D data. So if you try to do this on text, it's going to fail miserably. For text and other similar domains, there's something called inverted lists. I'm not actually going to talk about that. But this is a technique that's applicable to sparse data, data where there's lots of zeros. Text is a perfect example, and there's lots of other good examples where it works. It dramatically reduces the complexity. It's also an exact technique, so it's not, KD trees give you an approximation, they make mistakes. Inverted lists are exact. But they only apply when the data is sparse. So when there's lots of attributes with zero values. And then if you have high dimensional data, but it's not dense, then you can't use either of them. You can't use KD trees, because it doesn't work for high D. You can't use inverted lists, because it only works for sparse data. But there's another method that you use called fingerprinting, where basically you're taking your items and you're trying to come up with something like an MD5 code. Only it's different from an MD5 in the sense that items that are slightly different from each other will have the same hash code, will have the same fingerprint. And if you remember MD5s, you know, even a single bit change causes a totally different fingerprint. So the fingerprints in this method, they forgive small differences. Yes?
Sorry, just unclear. The identification of the small m neighbors is something that happens at testing time or training time?
No, this is a good question. So the way I presented it, this is something that you would do at the testing time. Now, something like inverted lists, there is a lot of processing that you do at the training time. You create a data structure that allows you fast lookups. KD trees are actually similar. You create a data structure at the training time that will then allow you to quickly look up the little n potential neighbors. All right. So let's look at an let's look at an example with KD trees, right? So suppose I have this set of data, and again, this is just a set of points. The way KD trees work is you iteratively do the following: you pick one of the attributes in your data. So in this case, how many attributes have I got? Two. There's only two, right? The x and the y. So I pick one of them. For this attribute, I'm going to find the median in the entire data set, and then I'm going to split based on this median. It's kind of like a decision tree, only instead of a gain and entropy and blah, 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 I just take the median, right? So half of them are going to be in the left, half of them are going to be in the right, according to one attribute. And then I'm going to recurse. So I'm going to go on the left subset, which has half the data points. I'm going to pick another attribute, take its median, get half above, half below, and then go on the right side, repeat the same thing. And keep repeating that until I sort of split up the data into a tree-like thing. Okay. So if I do it on the data set...
Sorry.
Thank you. So if I do it on this data set, and if I pick... let's say I pick the first attribute first, right? So what's the median? I have 1, 2, 4, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 7, 9. Right? If I just look at which number has the same number above and the same number below, and that turns out to be number 6, right? So if I pick number 6, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 items below it, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 items equal to or above. Right. So 6 is the median. So what I would do is I would pick 6 and I would split the data into two parts. So all of these points will go on the left side and all of those points will go on the right side. And then I'm going to do it recursively. So within this set, I'm going to look at the median of the y's of the second coordinate. Okay? And the median there, so I have what? I have the 9, the 3, the 1, the 7, and the 4. And the median of that is a 4, I guess. So if I pick a 4, then there's going to be two items that are smaller than that, and three items that are greater than or equal to that. Right. So that's what I'm going to this is the split that I'm going to have. And then I'm going to do the same thing on the other side. And I'm going to repeat this procedure until I have buckets that are small enough, right? And what does small enough mean? Small enough means they're small enough to where I'm willing to compare my testing point to everything in the bucket. I could keep splitting this, right, until I end up with singletons. But most of the time, you don't do that. You just stop when it's small enough. So if you try to draw this geometrically, what it looks like in the space, this is roughly it. So I'm just drawing the same set of points again. This first split where I'm taking the median of the first coordinate, this is this vertical line, right? So I pick the median and then I have a set of points on the left and a set of points on the right. And then within each one of those, I do the split on the y. So if I stop the tree after two splits, this would be the partition of the data that I have. So this is one bucket, this is another bucket, this is the third bucket, and this is the fourth bucket. Now, this is what I do at the training time. At the testing time, when I get a new test point, so say 7.4, the point falls right here. All I have to do is I have to figure out which bucket it goes into, so I compare the point, I compare 7 to the 6. Is it bigger or smaller? It's bigger, so I go to the right. I take the 4 and I compare it to the median, which is the 8. It's smaller, so I go to the left. So I end up in this bucket. So I would take 7.4 and compare it to 7.2 and 9.6. Those would be my potential nearest neighbors. Graphically, this is the point, and these are my two nearest neighbors. And what you see is it perfect? No, it made a mistake, right? So this point is actually closer to the test point than this neighbor. But I'm not going to get it. And the reason I'm not going to get it is because I drew a hard boundary. I said that the point is, it's on one side, but it's not on the other. So there are ways of dealing with that. So what you could do is you could actually, you could try to go up the tree and compare to a few points to the left and to the right to get a larger set of nearest neighbors. But it turns out that if you want to do this accurately, if you want to be sure that you get all of the nearest neighbors, then you actually have to consider the entire tree. So you're not saving any time. You're still comparing to every data point. You've just now added an extra layer of complexity in building this tree. Now, if you don't do this, if you're willing to tolerate some missing nearest neighbors, then this allows you to speed things up. Why? Because it only takes a logarithmic number of steps to go down the tree. And then within the tree, once you're in the bucket, the number of items is small. So you can actually, you can afford to compare to everything. Way to speed up the way KD tree, the way nearest neighbor works. It only works for low dimensional data, and it really stinks for sparse data. It doesn't work very well because the median of the sparse data is not a very well defined thing. So this is something that you want to do for low dimensional dense data. If you have other types of data, again, for sparse data, you want to do inverted lists. I'm not going to talk about this, and this is not going to be examinable. Remember the fingerprinting idea. Again, we're not going to talk about this. So let's summarize. The nearest neighbor, it's a very simple classifier. The basic idea is distances tell you something about the similarity of the class. If two points are near in space, they should have the same class label. That's the idea of the nearest neighbor classifier. You can use it for classification or regression by averaging. So it's a very simple classifier. It's very powerful in the sense that it can make nonlinear decision boundaries, and there are actually proofs. Nearest neighbor is asymptotically optimal. So you can prove that if you have an infinitely large number of training points, it's going to be within a certain factor of the best possible performance. Right? So it's asymptotically optimal. It doesn't make any assumptions about the data. So one way to think about it is sort of, it lets the data speak for itself. It doesn't assume that it's a tree. It doesn't assume that it's a plane. It doesn't assume independence. It doesn't assume anything. You do have to pick K. And you do have to pick a distance function. We talked about the way that distance function can affect things. And you do both of them by optimizing the error on a held out data set. And then it is not fast. It's slow for large data sets. But you do have a number of solutions for making it faster. All right? So as we're switching, yeah. For KD tree, does it have to be a median or not? So the median is going to result in the most balanced tree, right? You could obviously try something else. So if you have some biases in the data that you're aware of, then you should probably use something else. But out of the blue, if you don't know, then the median is a pretty good bet. Yes. All right, this is actually hard, and I'm not going to be able to do it on the spot. So one of the reasons is, what happens with a high dimensional data? So in a high dimensional data, every attribute contributes to the distance function. So here's a simple way to think about this. Your distance function is going to look at every attribute, right? In a tree, if you have a very large number of attributes, your tree is going to have to be pretty deep. Otherwise, your tree is only going to look at a very small fraction of those attributes. So if the tree looks at a very small fraction of the attributes, it's going to be inaccurate with respect to your distance function, right? because your distance function is based on 1,000 variables, and your KD tree looks at 5. Right? So that's not good. So ideally, you want to have as many levels in the tree as there are attributes. Only then your distance function can actually match the tree, possibly. But how many nodes are in the tree of D levels? 2 to the D, right? So if you have 1,000,000 attributes, imagine a tree having 2 to the million nodes. Are you going to have enough instances to populate this tree? No. So that's part of the problem. Was it? Okay.
Yeah, actually, I'll expand on that a little bit, maybe. So I agree with everything that Victor said. And in addition, this idea of dimensionality even affects k nearest neighbors more generally, whether you use a KD tree or not. And this is a little bit complicated to explain. The main idea is that high dimensions are weird. Like 100 dimensions doesn't act like 3 dimensions. And whatever you visualize in 2 or 3 dimensions, it doesn't completely carry over. And the reason for that is because areas get exponentially bigger in high dimensions. So you take a cube, right? Take the area of a cube, right? This area is cubic in the sides, right? But if I say take a hypercube, say I have 100 dimensions, well, the area of that is actually whatever the side length to the 100th. So in terms of the dimensionality, the area of every shape is exponential. So what that means is in high dimensions, you need more points to cover. If I have, let's say I have a lot of features that are all, say, in 0, 1. So if I have 2 features, I might not need a lot of points to cover a 1 by 1 square. But if I have 100 features, then I'll need a lot of points to cover a 1 by 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 1 hypercube, right? And this is exponentially many. And this has a lot of deep effects on a lot of learning algorithms, k-nearest neighbor being among them. And it's called in general the curse of dimensionality. The fact that things get really, really, really big as the dimensionality, exponentially big, as the dimensionality increases. And depending on time, we may say more about this later in the course. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and talk about something that is completely different, and that's going to be regression. So up until now, we have mostly been talking about classification. So classification is the situation in which the thing we are trying to predict is discrete, comes from this finite set of classes. So for today, we're going to talk about regression. So the thing we're going to predict is going to be continuous. So our training data is going to be as before, that we have a set of input vectors that we call x. And I, as before, is going to index the training items. And our outputs are going to be y, but now we're going to have y live in the set of real numbers, as opposed to being a finite set of class labels. And also for this lecture, I'm going to assume that all of my features are real valued. And that's just going to help with a notation that's not as much of an assumption as you might think. We'll talk about that in a bit. For this lecture, we're going to focus on the simplest kind of regression, which is linear regression. This is a very classical method. It's something that's been studied for hundreds of years in statistics. And this is the situation in which the relationship between x and y is linear. So this is kind of the dumbest, simplest assumption you can make if you actually want to solve the regression problem. But there are lots of reasons why this is important to study. The first is, it actually turns out that this is more powerful than you would expect. And we'll see why that is. The second thing is, further on in the course, we're going to talk about methods that actually are nonlinear, that give you more flexibility than linear regression. And it turns out that many of those will be generalizations of linear methods. So it makes sense to look at linear methods first and then to extend them to nonlinear methods. And the final thing is a lot of issues that come up generally in regression and in classification, we can see in a simpler framework by looking at linear regression. So there are lots of regression problems that we might want to look at. So here are some examples of cases within artificial intelligence and within statistics more generally, that we might want to predict a real valued variable. So one example would be, say, within robotics. So if I wanted to do some kind of planning, if I had some kind of planning, I'm trying to figure out what to do with a robot arm. So I know that I want to move the arm in this direction, but I don't know exactly how, what kind of angular velocity, what kind of torque I need to put on these three joints in order to do that. In some cases, you can model that deterministically, but you can also try to learn that mapping. And if you did that, then you'd be trying to predict these real valued numbers of these angular velocities, which would be a regression problem. There are also lots of forecasting problems that are naturally cast as regression problems. So one example might be in the power grid. If I'm trying to predict how much power each location in Scotland is going to use in the next hour, and that might help me to do some kind of management of different resources in the grid. You could imagine a similar problem in the financial sector. If I'm trying to predict what some stock is going to be like in the next hour, that could also be a real value problem. And also anything, so a similar problem would be, you know, if you had some kind of health, if I wanted to predict demand of some kind of service. So if I had some kind of help desk for the University of Edinburgh computing support, and I want to know how many people to employ at each point in time to sit at the help desk, then I might want to predict how many people are going to come to the help desk per hour. And that could be cast as a regression problem, where I'm trying to predict an integer number of people. And finally, a final example would be something if I want to predict equipment failure. So maybe I want to predict how much time is my laptop going to run before it fails, before the hard drive crashes or it runs out of power or whatever. And that might be, that's also an example of a regression problem. Okay. I hope this delivery isn't for us. So in the linear regression problem, what we're going to do is, I'm going to denote by f is our prediction of the function. So this is going to be the output of the regression problem that says, given x, this f of x is going to be our prediction of the output. So this is going to protect, this f is going to depend on some parameters. These parameters are w, and we're going to try to figure those out as part of the learning process. So in linear regression, this function f of xw takes a special form. So we're going to have, for each of these input features, x1 through xd, we're going to have one weight. And what we're going to do is we're going to say f is linear in w. So it's going to be w0 plus w1 plus x1, and so forth. So to write that more compactly, I'm going to use a vector notation. So rather than writing this thing up here over and over again, I'm just going to say it's the dot product. And I want to avoid this kind of having to write w0 over and over again. So instead of saying w transpose x here, I'm going to say w transpose phi of x. And what phi is going to be is going to be a vector that's going to give me everything in x plus a 1 at the end. So that way I get this kind of intercept term without having to mess up my notation. Another reason I'm going to use phi is it's going to turn out to be a little bit easier when we generalize linear models to nonlinear models. So here's an example of what we're trying to do in linear regression. I have some, my input is going to be some cloud of points like this, where I have one feature x, and that's my input, and then I'm going to try to predict y. So each of these y heights is the true value of y for each of these elements in the training data. And when I predict in linear regression, that's going to give me a line like this, where this line is w0 plus w1 times x. That's the equation for this line here. So that's in one dimension. In two dimensions, I'm not going to have a line. I'm going to have a plane. So now if I have two features, x1 and x2, and in the training data, I'm given the true value for y, that gives me this cloud of red points here. And what I'm trying to find is a plane in two dimensions that would look something like this that tries to fit these red points as closely as possible. And if I have more than two features, then instead of having a plane, I'm going to have a hyperplane. So here's a simple example of a data set with more than two features. This is one that you'll probably see in one of the labs later on in the course. And this is an old, very old data set, maybe 25 years old, about predicting CPU performance. So if you're interested in predicting the performance of obsolete CPUs, then this is the data set for you.
But it's kind of useful illustratively, and it's an open data set, so it's reasonable to talk about. The Y that we're trying to predict is this thing that's called PRP in the data set. And that's they just ran a benchmark on a number of microprocessors, and PRP is sort of the relative performance. So it's the ratio of the performance of a processor to some baseline. And each of these features is some kind of value of the value of the microprocessor. So it could be something like the clock rate from INCT. It could be some these things have to do with how much memory the system has, and this has to do with how much cache it has, obviously very important. And these things talk about what kinds of channels to memory that it has. And the kind of thing that I'm looking for is something like this, where I say the performance of my processor is going to be some intercept, this is W0, plus all of these features have a weight. You know, the ones with higher weight you think would be more important. So it turns out things like, oh, look, actually the amount of memory in this, if this were the learned model, you'd see, well, the amount of memory, that's not so important. These have very small weight. Whereas the size of the cache, that's a lot more important. Well, that makes a lot of sense. So we want to be able to infer something like this from data. And that's what we're going to see how to do today. So there's some more notation that I want to introduce in order to make things, in order to be able to state solution to this linear regression very compactly. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write all of the training examples, and I'm going to squash them together into a matrix. And that matrix I'm going to call phi, capital phi, because each one of these things, remember, was phi of x. So what each row of this matrix is going to be one of the training examples plus one. So this will be the first example, the second example, and so on. So the dimensionality of this matrix is the number of rows is the number of data points n, and the number of columns is the number of features plus one. That's the dimensionality of the matrix. And a y will be all the training outputs squashed together. That'll be this boldface y. So now let's do some, and remember w was this vector. It has the same length as d plus one. Those are the weights. Those are the parameters of the model that we're trying to learn. So say I take this matrix b, and I multiply it by w. Say I take phi and I multiply it by w. What does that give me? What is that? Yeah.
It's the prediction
for... That's right. It's a prediction for all of the training points. So it gives you a vector for each training point where you get the prediction of the model. If w is the weights, it gives you the prediction of the model on that training point. Here's how you can work that out really quickly. What you do is you use a one-slide crash course on linear algebra. So what linear algebra is all about is what matrix multiplication is, right? Because when I first saw matrix multiplication, my first thought, you know, when I was a student, was something like WTF, right? Why would you define multiplication in this way, right? Why don't you just like, you know, multiply together individual values in the matrix or something like that? Well, it turns out there's some really nice intuition behind why matrix multiplication is the way it is. So here's two different ways to think about multiplying a matrix times a vector. It turns out you can extend these to matrix times matrix, but I won't get into that. We don't need that today. So the first way is when I multiply a matrix A times a vector B, what I'm doing is B is giving me a linear combination of the columns of A. So if you say each one of these things, if you match up the numbers, is a column of A, and B is specifying a linear combination of these columns. That's one way you can think about it. So now if you remember thinking about like column spaces and stuff like that in linear algebra, this is why we care. So the second way you can think about it is that, remember, AB is a vector. Each element of the vector is a dot product between B and one row of A. So you see what I'm writing here, you see I'm writing the dot product this way, it's actually matrix multiplication because B is a column vector, and A, I'm just keeping as a row vector, so that I don't have any transpose here because things are already in the right dimension. Each one of these things is a dot product. So now if I go back and look at this, so now if you think about this way of thinking about linear algebra, then you can immediately see what this is, because each row is the dot product of W and phi of x. So then you immediately see that y hat, and so we're going to call this y hat because it's an estimate of the y on the training data. So hat usually means estimate, is the model's predicted value on the training inputs. So now what we want to do is we want to figure out the parameters of the model. So what we have is I have this equation for y, and I know y and I know phi, right? But I don't know w. So we know how to do this from linear algebra.
What you should do
is you should multiply both sides by phi inverse. So I'll say w equals phi inverse y. And that's how you should solve linear regression. So why isn't that how you should solve linear regression? Yeah. Yeah, so for one, phi isn't square, so you can't even think about an inverse. That's one reason. There's another one, too.
Must be invertible?
Yeah. So what would it mean for phi to not be invertible in this case? Yeah.
Two proportional vectors.
Yeah. So that would be, that can lead to some complications, like if I have one feature that's, say, two times another feature. That can kind of lead to some technical complications. It turns out that software for handling linear algebra knows how to solve that. I don't want to get into that until I actually explain what the solution is to the linear regression problem. So basically, it has to do with noise in the data set, right? So not only is this phi not square, but typically, I'm going to have more equations than I have unknowns, right? So I'm going to have this large number of data points. If I have a larger number of data points than parameters, which is often the case for some kinds of regression problems, then the system is over-constrained. So what you see is it turns out that these two are the same thing. So if I go back, let me go back here. So this thing leads to some, if I had a perfect linear algebra solution to that, it would be one in which phi times w, so let's go to one dimension. A perfect solution, one where I really could do phi inverse, would be one for which w times x actually equaled y for every single point. And that's only possible if the relation is really linear and if there's no noise. So with So in most cases, this equation doesn't actually have a perfect solution. Because most of the time, I don't actually believe that the method's linear. I don't actually believe the relationship's linear. I just believe that might be a good enough approximation for now. And I typically believe the data has noise. So this is only appropriate when I know that there's actually going to be a solution to these equations. In particular, usually, there is no solution. I just want to find the vector that comes closest to being a solution. So here's how I'm going to do that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to define something called a loss function. So I'm going to define a function that measures how well the predictions from the linear regression match what I actually saw in the training data. I'm going to call this thing O. So I'm going to view this thing O. It's going to be kind of like likelihood. Remember, we saw likelihood was a function of the parameters that measured how well the parameters fit the data. So a likelihood is one example of a loss function. So we're going to see another loss function today. And what we're going to do after we see this loss function is we're going to minimize it with respect to w. So we'll find the set of parameters that causes these y hats to be as close as possible to the real y's. So there's lots of ways you could choose the loss function. You could come up with a probabilistic model that you really believed in and use the likelihood. What we're going to do is we're just going to use squared error. The reason we're going to do that is it makes the math really, really easy. And it's kind of intuitive. So what this corresponds to here is, say I had this two-dimensional example again. Each one of these, what color are they? Black. Black sticks is if I took this red point and I dropped it down to the hyperplane defined by WTX, right? So this is the error. This is YI minus WTX is the length of each of those black sticks. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to square them, because that way they're all positive. And then I'm going to try to minimize this. So each one of these things is called a residual. And I'm going to try to minimize, just an error. And I'm going to try to minimize the sum over the squared errors. That's going to be my loss function. So what this is going to, so if I look at this, remember this is a quadratic function. So I can write this out. This is kind of intuitive little summation. I could also write this out in matrix form, right? Feet w gave me this y hat, so I could just take y minus y hat and basically square it. And that'll give me the same thing. So this is a quadratic function with respect to w. So if I plot it, this plot, so this was something where, say, I only have two weights, then, and this is weight 0, this is weight 1, the actual error function, this thing O, is going to look like a quadratic bowl. And I want to find the point in W space that minimizes that bowl. Now, how do we minimize things? How do we minimize continuous things? Yeah, you take the, sorry, I didn't hear you.
Sorry, differentiate?
Yeah, you differentiate. So we're just going to take the derivative of this and set it to 0. I'm not going to go through that calculation. It's not that bad. But it turns out you get something that looks like, it turns out what you get in matrix notation is this. So this is the set, remember, these are the inputs, these phi are the inputs, and y are the output of the training data. And what you get is this. So now, so the key thing that's going on here is I'm taking this matrix, which looks kind of crazy to begin with, and that's this phi transpose phi inverse times phi transpose. So whenever you see an equation with lots of matrices in it, there's a couple things you should do. The first thing you should do is make sure there aren't any typos. And a quick way to do that is to say, what are the dimensions of this thing, right? So this thing y, so remember I said phi has, actually, let me, so when I take phi transpose, I get d times n, so that matches y. And then, so now once I do phi transpose y, so phi transpose y will be d times 1. So that'll be a column vector. And then phi transpose phi, well, that'll be d times n times n times d. So this will be d times d. So sum will be inverse. So now I'm taking a d times d, times a d times 1. So getting a d times 1 vector, and that's what I want for the weights. Okay, so that at least parses. It's syntactically correct. The other thing, the other easy way to remember this, is that it's called something called a pseudo-inverse of phi. So why would you call this something like a pseudo-inverse? Yeah?
If phi was invertible, then that should be the inverse.
Yeah, right. I hadn't thought about that. I guess that's right. If phi was invertible, that would actually be the inverse. Yeah, right? Because what would happen is that this thing would now go through this. So I get phi inverse, then I get phi transpose inverse, phi transpose. Yeah, that's true. Another way you can look at it is if I take this thing and I multiply it by phi, then I'll get should get the, what, d times d identity matrix. Because I'll have phi transpose phi times phi transpose phi. So it's like, so it kind of looks like, so it's not... So it looks like something, so it's something that actually gives you the identity matrix. So it's like the inverse in that case. The other thing you can do is you could say, if you want to kind of make this, if you have this big equation with lots of matrices, is you can say, let me make them all scalars. So I'll make d equals 1, and then look at what this equation does. And then what you'll get is that's the case where you have only one data point. So what you'll be doing there, is that would be the case since we always have the ones. You can look at it this way. So if you had no features at all, so the only feature you had in phi, or does that matter? Yes, it does matter. So you can break this down. So this is something like saying phi over phi squared, right? Which it's not quite right, but you can see in the scalar case, you would get something like that. And then you would just get, you would just say, well, the slope is y over x, which is kind of makes sense too. So there's lots of ways you can parse this thing. You don't really need to be able to, I'm not asking you to memorize this thing, but you should be able to see, oh, okay. So in principle, I could just write one line of MATLAB that multiplies some matrices together, and I'd have the solution to this least squares problem. Okay. So I lied a little bit when I was telling you about this. So I talked about this as like an alternative to likelihood. You don't have to believe in likelihood at all. in order to use linear regression, or least squares. But there's kind of an interesting interpretation of this, which is has the likelihood of a Gaussian. Right? So a Gaussian is basically e to the minus x squared. So it makes sense that if I take the log of a Gaussian, I'll get something that looks like squared error. And that's basically what this thing says. So what? So the probabilistic interpretation of this loss function is that we can define a probability distribution over y given x. And if we choose that in a clever way, it's not actually that clever, but in a particular way, then you get from the log likelihood of that model, you get this least squares objective function that we've already seen. And so what that model is I'll just say, given an input point, my distribution over y is going to be normal. The mean of that Gaussian distribution is going to be just this linear function wt plus x. And the standard deviation is sigma squared. It's going to be something arbitrary. Something arbitrary that doesn't depend on x. So this is the same thing as saying that y is exactly this linear function plus Gaussian noise. So these two things are equivalent. Now, if I believed this has my probability model, and then I took the log likelihood, what I would get would be something like this. This just is just the Gaussian equation that we saw from lecture 2, or whatever it was, with a log in front of it, and with this mean. So then what you get is something like this, and when I minimize this likelihood with respect to w, these terms go away. This term also doesn't affect the location of the maximum, because it's a constant with respect to w. So what I get is that minimizing this O of w, this least squares that we've already seen, is equivalent to maximizing this likelihood. And what this WTX gives you is, in this interpretation, this dot product WTX is the expected value of y given x. So if I took the expected value here of y, this epsilon is going to go away because it has mean zero. It's the expected value. So WTX is the expected value of y given x. This also lets you estimate sigma squared. So if you wanted to estimate the spread of the points around that regression line, what you can do is subtract out this linear relation. What you have left are, you think, samples from this epsilon, and then you can estimate the standard deviation of epsilon if you didn't think that it was 0, 1, if you thought it was 0 sigma squared. So that's kind of a nice connection to know about. It's important in statistics, because they want to, if you want to kind of prove certain theorems about W, then it helps to have this interpretation. Okay, so let's let's talk about, in the beginning we talked about how many learning algorithms can be viewed in a particular structure. There are three things that we mainly wanted to separate. That is the fact that you can have a model structure where you optimize in a number of different ways. So in this case, the model structure was, we wanted to find a linear function. Once you decide you want to find a linear function, you could, in principle, pick any way you wanted in order to get the best parameters. The one that we happened to pick in this lecture was squared error. Next lecture, we'll see a different way of picking it. That's related but different to squared error. So this is the particular, so we were looking for the linear regression method that minimizes squared error. Once I decide that, I could try to minimize that using whatever algorithm I want. And there are many algorithms for doing minimization. It turned out, in this case, we could do something really simple, and that was calculus. We just set the derivatives to zero. So next lecture, we'll start to see a few nonlinear extensions to linear regression. Okay, see you next week.
I err on the side of talking too fast, so I was trying to correct.
can't believe how visible that chalk is. It's amazing.
It's not that expensive either.